as you yourselves know, besides the other activities organized by this association, it has also set aside this hour to offer greater help in a certain way to its audience, to the members of the association in general, and to others who attend, especially concerning the themes of each Sunday. For I would like to believe that the association believes that the Church of Christ, which alone possesses the Holy Spirit, has particular reasons for reminding us each year of certain events from the life of our Christ and elements of his teaching. If a person were willing to assimilate in faith and works everything connected with the 52 Sundays of the year, that alone would be enough to help him attain salvation. This, of course, does not prevent him from going further and learning all the other things that are available, for they are all meant for us. With all these thoughts in mind, I too shall try at this hour, by the grace of the Lord and through the intercessions of the saint whom this association honors, to present certain events that can benefit us both in this present age and in the age to come. This Sunday is called by our church the Sunday of the Blind Man. Those of you who went to church will have heard this gospel account, which tells how our Christ healed a blind man whom he encountered there near Jericho. As I saw when I took a brief look, two other evangelists also speak about this event, Mark in chapter 10 and Matthew in chapter 20, where he mentions it in verse 21. Indeed, Matthew speaks of two blind men. Mark gives the most details and even tells us the blind man's name. But since the appointed sequence is from Luke, our church takes this account from the apostle and evangelist Luke, chapter 18, from verse 35 onward. Allow me to read it little by little, and let us discuss it as we go. This is how the evangelist relates the event. Now it happened, as he drew near to Jericho, that a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. This is a scene we still see today in villages and cities, people who do not possess this gift of sight, and who in one way or another beg for alms, people who are especially in need. Of course, I do not know anyone who is not in need in such a condition. Yet those who lost their sight later in life may perhaps not be in material need. Others, however, are even used by people around them and made to beg. In any case, we do not know the man's financial circumstances. What we do know is that he was a man without sight. I do not know whether you have ever reflected on sight, on this gift of light, whether you value it as you should, and whether you glorify and thank God for this gift of light. For a person to open his eyes in the morning and see the light, to see creation, this is a great thing. Sadly, we are ungrateful and forgetful of the Lord's gifts. We grieve Him when we ought to be thanking Him for this great gift of light. Through reading and seeing, we are given the opportunity, if we are people of good intent, to enter more deeply into the mystery of creation and the Creator. For a human being, and above all a Christian, is someone who sees a watch and understands that there must be a watchmaker. Such a person is not like those who look at creation and never reckon with the Creator. The heavens, as the psalmist says, declare the glory of God, and woe to those who went right up among the works of creation and still did not find God there. Woe to those people! If you were to ask someone knowledgeable about sight, an ophthalmologist, you would be left open-mouthed as he tried to describe it to you. He can describe it certainly, but he cannot reproduce it, because the fact that a human being can see is a mystery. A person does not actually see with the eye. The eye is an instrument. Just as these glasses of mine do not see, but my eyes see through them, so it is with the eyes themselves. Yes, these specialists describe this and that and so forth, but they cannot reproduce it. It remains a mystery. Before this mystery, a person should bend the knee in reverence before God and say, "My God, what is this? How is it that I can see?" For many times we look and yet do not see, just as we hear and yet do not hear. That is because someone else makes use of this instrument called the eye. Of course, it must be kept in good condition. We must protect it, preserve it, and care for it. We should not feed the body with things that will harm this sacred organ, this great instrument that God has given to man. That is why the ancients used to say, "It is the nose that sees and the nose that hears." We do not see with our eyes. It is with the nous, the spiritual intellect, that we see through the eyes. In any case, it is one great faculty among the many other great faculties found in the human person. What has God not fashioned in us? And what part of the human person is not precious? Yet sadly, as I have said, we do not thank God for these things. We are saddened when we see a blind person, and we try to find words with which to comfort him, and so forth. Yet we ourselves give no thought to what we possess, and we do not say to Christ, "My God, I am not worthy of this light." Worse still is the case, not only of ungrateful and thankless people, but also of those who use this gift for evil. It was given for what is good, so that everything good might enter through it. Yet a person turns it into a channel for poisonous things and uses it for evil. This is not the time to explain what it means to use one's sight for evil, or how that is done. In any case, this man was blind. The evangelist Luke tells us in just a few words that he sat there begging, seeking the means to support himself. At that very moment, as he was begging there, Christ was passing by with his followers. Evidently, a great crowd was following Christ. They were surely not passing right beside him. There must have been some distance between them, and hearing a crowd passing by, he asked what this might mean. In other words, he became uneasy. "What is this? I hear the tramping of feet," as people say in everyday language. "What can be going on?" He took an interest and asked what this was. The noise, what lies behind this noise? Who is this? What is the cause of this noise? And if I carry this over to another scene, one that takes place every Sunday and feast day, wherever there is any Christian presence at all, any Christian community, Christians ring the church bells. In some places they have managed to stop the bells from ringing. That is what happens here as well. In the Jewish manner, the bells are not rung, for it is the bells that convict people's souls and consciences, and people do not want any discussion of the things for which they are guilty. The prayer. It puts out its feelers, and then it hides them again, even though it knows perfectly well that it has them, and though it might well boast about having them, instead it keeps them hidden. That is how we were too. The bells are ringing. Whoever asks why the bells are ringing? And for whom are the bells tolling? As the familiar expression says, who asks why these bells are ringing, what purpose they serve, and what the people behind those bells are teaching? Many people hear them, but they do not ask. This reminds me, and I shall take the point a little further, of what happened on the afternoon of Pascha. I mean, what those men said to Christ as he journeyed toward Emmaus, as you know, those two even reproached Christ. "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there? Do you not know what happened? What excuse do you have? Where have you been? Are you not someone who goes about in public and knows what people are talking about? Do you not know what has happened in these days?" They were correcting Christ, he says, as it were. "I do not know. I was not there. I know nothing about these things." Do you understand? They assumed that everyone ought to know what had happened. And think of Greece today, where we hear the church bells even while we are still in our mother's womb. Yet sadly, there are people who know nothing about any of this. Who rings the bells? Who stands behind them? What do they teach and proclaim? Most of us do not know our relationship with Jesus is merely outward and superficial, not what it ought to be. This man, then, whether moved by a holy curiosity or by something else, I do not know, asked, "Tell me, what is it?" And from that question, "What is it?" something emerged. What came from his asking? Hidden within that noise was the light that would be given to his eyes. And with it came the assurance that his name would be remembered throughout eternity. The great and powerful figures of every age have died and been buried. Yet this simple little man, scorched there by the dry wind and the sun, has remained written in this account. He will be read about for all eternity, and his name will be remembered because he was not indifferent. He cared enough to learn what was happening. What joy belongs to those who, whenever they hear such a commotion, take an interest and seek to understand these matters more deeply. In any case, when those who were passing by were asked, "My children, Who is passing by? What is it? What is happening? They replied. Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He is the cause of all the commotion. And you know what a stir Christ has caused, and what a stir Christ will yet cause this Nazarene, the son of Mary. A stir such as Napoleon never caused, such as Napoleon never caused. Alexander caused a commotion. Hitler and Stalin did as well, and so did others. But all their noise concerned outward things. Here the matter concerns human consciences, so that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed, as the elder Simeon says so concisely on the feast of the meeting of the Lord. This Christ, this sign that is spoken against, the sign men contradict, is the very one now being spoken of. Jesus, they say, the Nazarene is passing by. And of course he caught the meaning of it. He got the point, as we say in our own language. He showed that he knew about Jesus the Nazarene. And not only did he know about Jesus the Nazarene, he knew a great deal more than that. The proof is that he cried out to him, not simply to help him, but to have mercy on him in his need. He was certainly not asking him to pay his rent or to summon a doctor and obtain some medicine for him. He was speaking to him about his eyes, and human beings cannot make eyes whole. In his cry and invocation, he acknowledged that Christ possessed higher powers, something supernatural, something divine. Moreover, he called him by his biblical title. While the others told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by, he rightly took the name Jesus and cried aloud, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Son of David, how did you know that he is the Son of David? Although he was blind, he evidently perceived what truly mattered. His soul was thirsty, and it seems that he went to the synagogues where preaching took place, or perhaps, who knows, he asked someone else to read to him. In this way, he had formed an understanding of who Jesus was. Now, this is nothing to wonder at. We see it in other simple people as well. What did Andrew say to Peter? What did Philip say to Nathanael? We have found him of whom Moses wrote in the law and the prophets, Jesus of Nazareth. You men out there with the dragnet, what business do you have with letters? What business do you have with books? And yet, the one about whom the scriptures write, he was the very one they had been reading about. Christ makes it hard for no class of people, no trade, no age, no level of learning. Everyone is called by him to come and to learn about Jesus. For even if a person learns everything else, if he fails to learn this one thing, it would have been better for him to learn nothing at all, better even if he had never come into this world. Luke himself writes in Acts 4:12, Nor is there salvation in any other, no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Acts 4:12. There is no other name. Learn everything you can, but if you do not learn this, you have no salvation. You must learn about Jesus, where he came from, why he came, and where he is going. And we too must learn the same things about ourselves, where we came from, why we came, and where we are going. Many people think that we came here to stay, but as you know, we did not come to stay, we came to leave. This is a grave mistake, and I hear many people make it. People say that I am an inhabitant of the earth, but I am not an inhabitant of the earth, I am a tenant on the earth. A tenant, we live here as though paying rent. Here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. If a person realizes that he is not a permanent resident, but a tenant, and that one day he will be evicted, then he will conduct his life differently. Many times we fail to notice the subtle, satanic way in which words are altered, and so we lose their meaning. Take the word cemetery, for example. To speak merely of a place of the dead is wrong. It is a sleeping place. This is a serious matter, because the departed person is not merely dead, but asleep. A place of the dead says nothing to me about awakening, whereas a sleeping place, a bedroom, reminds me that I shall awaken. These may seem like small details, but Satan arranges them very cleverly in order to draw people away, attacking them from both the right and the left. The Creed says, Pi hontiu helatu savro theta, changing epi to po. We say pi ontiu helatu, not po thontiu helatu. Who pays attention to such a thing? St. Athanasius the Great suffered for 20 years rather than concede even a single iota. These fine points, then, are essential for us, because if we let them slip away, we are left all at sea. We begin to think that we came here to stay. We have clung to this world like oysters to a rock, and you know what people will do for the sake of this world. Yet one day, in the name of the Constitution and the state, they will remove us from this room. We shall depart from here. Therefore, whether we live in a house of our own or in a rented home, as souls and as human beings, we are only tenants in this world. We brought nothing with us, and we shall take nothing away. We are simply stewards. Once we understand this, everything changes. A person begins to look more deeply, to conduct his life differently, and not to grow hard. He makes ready, he prepares himself. All these details matter. But we forget this. Here, then, we see this man calling Christ by his biblical name. This proves that although he was blind, he nevertheless took an interest in matters of faith, and in the concerns of his soul, he truly cared about them. And when a person shows such eagerness despite adversity, you see, many people want everything to be easy. It may be easy to become a doctor, a lawyer, a ruler, a king, and so forth. But to become a Christian is the most difficult thing in the world. It is the most difficult thing. All the forces of the devil will rise against you. In every other pursuit, the demons may even help you rise higher. But when you try to become a simple Christian, every kind of adversity will stand against you. Yet nothing can truly hinder a person if he genuinely wills it and longs for it. It is like someone who is in love. For the lover there are no obstacles. There are no borders and no chains for a soul that is in love. Such a person will do even the wildest things to attain the object of his love. That is the kind of love we ought to have in the highest degree for Christ. Yet this love and this deep concern are missing from the relationship between our soul and Christ. That is why many people complain that they meet difficulties in life. But what do you expect to encounter? If you go with the current, it will carry you to the waterfall and plunge you down. If you go against the current, naturally you will meet its resistance, but then you will possess the grounds and the necessary conditions for salvation. So let us not seek an easy Christianity. There is no Christian life that passes through everything with ease, either in preaching or in daily living. Everything must pass through fire and iron. This is necessary. Those who went before rebuked him, telling him to be silent. They told him, in effect, "Be quiet, shut your mouth," or as we carelessly say at times, "shut up." Instead of helping him, these people with perfectly good eyesight, who were walking with Christ, saw the man and knew that Christ had power not only over blindness, but over tombs, lepers, and the demon-possessed as well. He sees no obstacle. He sets everything right. So why, my good man, do you not stop the Lord and say, "Teacher Rabuni, I do not know what you would call him. Master, here is this poor fellow, exposed to the scorching wind and the blazing sun." Why did you not tell him, not only did they fail to do this, but when the man asked Christ for mercy, they stepped in and became an obstacle. And though they went forward to see, they did not. And notice this detail. It was not strangers who did this, nor indifferent people. The obstacle was placed in his way by those who were with Christ. Do you understand? This is a great lesson, if we pay attention to it. Of course, you have considered it carefully. You know it. Keep it in mind, and can surely explain it better than I am doing at this moment. Nevertheless, with my own poor strength, I tell you again, pay attention to it. These were people who were with him, with Christ. Some of them had been shown mercy in one way or another. Some had gone to seek him, some believed in him, and each had his own story. Of course, he also had the bad one there among them, but that was the least of it. And yet, in spite of all that, not only did they not help him, they actually stood in his way. And who stood in his way? The world. A person has three basic obstacles, three basic enemies. They are the flesh, the world, and Satan. Satan comes last. Never put Satan first. Never blame Satan in order to justify yourself. The wound is mine. The injury is mine. I am the cause. Satan can do nothing unless we give him room. Unless we ourselves open the door to him, Satan can do nothing. No human being, not even the devil himself, can tempt and harm a person. Do you remember what Chrysostom wrote? Golden John, eh? No one can harm John unless John harms himself. No one can harm me unless I harm myself. Let us not blame other people. Let us not even blame Satan, as so many have learned to do. Saint Gregory, whom we celebrate today, and the divine Chrysostom both reproach us for this. Why do you blame the wretched devil, he says, because he set fire to the dry brushwood that you yourself had gathered. You pile up the brushwood, he says, and he sets it on fire. Do not gather dry brushwood, and he will have nothing to set on fire. Can he set the sea on fire? No, he cannot. But as long as you keep gathering dry brushwood, Satan will set it ablaze. As long as you keep creating the necessary conditions, leaving the way open, and failing to prevent the causes. So how do you expect to heal the effects? The world, at any rate, is the second beast, the second enemy of the human soul. The first enemy is the flesh. Our Christ showed this clearly, of course, in his temptations. If you read the fourth chapter of Matthew and the fourth chapter of Luke, you will see the three principal temptations of Christ after his regeneration, that is, his baptism. You will see there that his flesh was tempted. He had fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. He was also tempted by the world, by the desire to be seen and admired by men. He was told to cast himself down, but he did not. I call the flesh the first enemy because you cannot cast it away or shut it outside yourself. You take the flesh with you even into the church, to the table, to bed, to the bathroom, on the road, and on a journey, you cannot close the door on it. Leave me alone. And you hang up the phone, leave me alone, and you shut the world outside if you want to. With the flesh you can't. That is why it is the number one enemy. Every day it comes and deceitfully corrupts the immortal soul, and a person needs to keep taking precautions. According to Job, Satan's seat is at the navel of the belly. The second beast is the one we see here today, standing between Christ and this suffering man. Anyone who desires to see Christ and come into contact with Christ must be very careful of the world. Unless he closes one ear to the world, he cannot hear Christ with the other. It is impossible. When I spoke on New Year's Day, I gave an illustration that is still relevant, so I will repeat it now. A man inside a large shop was telephoning someone. The other person kept shouting to him from the other end, "I cannot hear you." "Why does he keep shouting that he cannot hear me?" the man said. "I am speaking loudly." Yet the other kept saying, "I cannot hear you." The man was calling from a telephone booth inside the shop. "I can hear voices and crowds around you," the other said. "What is going on?" "I am calling you from a booth inside a shop." "Close the door," the other replied. "Shut the world outside so that I can speak to you." So he closed the door, shut the world outside, and they were able to communicate. He could hear what the other man was saying. How, then, do you expect to hear Christ, my friend, when you do not shut the world outside, when your home, your ears, and everything else remain wide open to the world? How can you possibly hear what Christ is saying? You may have gone and knelt beneath the Holy Gospel while it was being read, or passed beneath the Epitaphios on Great Friday, but it was all false. You knelt beneath the Holy Gospel merely to make your headaches go away, and you passed beneath the Epitaphios out of superstition. Demons, not so that you may bow down before one, but saying, "Bend my head, make me stoop, and pass beneath it, so that your will may be done, so that you may be my Lord, and I may be your servant for the sake of my salvation." We can never draw near to God while serving one master here and another there. You must shut out the world, and on this point I would like to say the following. Many times, for us, the world that becomes an obstacle between Christ and us is not necessarily what people commonly call the world. Often the world can be found within your own home. It may be your brother, your aunt, your godmother, your sponsor, or even your benefactor. Someone who has done you a great deal of good, and yet in this sense, still be the world. You are called to close the door on all these people if you wish to hear what God is saying to you. for if you're unwilling to close the door to the world, it is very difficult to hear what God is telling you. And above all, obey what God tells you. The world contains so many evils that hinder a person from drawing near to Christ. Today the churches were mostly empty, while people stayed up until dawn in their homes last night. In the apartment building where I live, the people in all 15 apartments stayed up until dawn. Some were playing cards, some were partying, some were engaging in corruption, and so on. That is what the world wants. That is the world. And this is how people imagine they will find satisfaction. Wanting to show that he belongs to the world, a person follows the ways of the world. Some have gone into debt to impress the world by buying a car. Others have ruined their families through the car. Still others are in debt and are being pursued by installment collectors because they bought a TV. They bought it because the world demanded it, not because they needed it. Do they truly need these things? Many people sit down and fall asleep in front of the TV, but how could they show their faces if their home did not even have a TV antenna? Every house has sprouted an antenna. Is theirs going to be the only roof without one? How could that be? The world wants this thing, do you see? Or take other things. The woman has become a man. Why? For the world. The man has become a woman. Why? For the world. Many don't fast because of the world. Many don't have children because of the world. Others are afraid to raise their hand and make the sign of the cross. They do it down low, or not at all, because of the world. The world is a great beast. It takes strength for a person even to see it for what it is. A person must shut the world outside, whatever form that world may take, whether it is someone in his immediate surroundings, in his own home, in his office, at his workplace, or anywhere else. If he does not have this strength, he should put up that partition between your work and mine and to lose the friendship of this world. Christ gave us those beautiful words, "If your right eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out." He is not telling you literally to tear out your eye, for then your left eye would still remain. If people in your immediate circle hold the place of your right eye, yet cause you to stumble, becoming the reason your soul falls into sin and is lost, it is better to die as a shoeshine boy, better to die in a ditch, and so forth, than to rely on such a person and keep him beside you. This is what he means when he says, "Pluck it out." Think about that. Consider what it truly means, and how much strength a person needs in order to recognize that the world is a great beast, the second great enemy, as I told you. In simple words, I want to share with you a few thoughts of St. Gregory the Theologian, whose feast we are keeping today, and I do this to honor him. But I will give them to you in paraphrase, not word for word. He says this, "Do not let your heart be charmed or sweetened by the things of this world. Do not surrender your heart to them. Do not love the vanity of this world. Do not seek the falsehood of this world. Do not imagine that this present life is something great. Do not suppose that happiness is found in luxury and indulgence." He says this, "Do not imagine that revelry, fleeting glory, or petty worldly power is happiness. In a word, let nothing pleasant or pleasurable in this world draw your heart toward it, because this is what it is. It is like dust scattered by the wind, and like smoke that dissolves, such is this world, like a dream that plays before us, and like a shadow that cannot be grasped." Someone may say, "But the world, you can see it." Yes, and if there are Christians today who are influenced by the world, you can recognize them when you approach them. You see them with their packet of cigarettes, their newspaper, their television, their worry beads, their backgammon, their other amusements, their hunting and so forth, and yet they tell you, "I'm a Christian." If these people are still influenced by this world and occupy themselves with the things of this world, they have never tasted the things of the world above. Have you heard what a cat does when it smells fish in the kitchen? It keeps circling around outside, as the saying goes, because it knows what's in there. It already has a foretaste of those fish heads, and round it goes. Many Christians have never tasted this. That is why St. John of the Ladder says about it, "Whoever has tasted the things above easily despises the things below. Once you have tasted what is above, you think nothing of what is below." But the one who has never tasted the things above rejoices in things that pass away. Whoever has tasted the things above, he says, regards all these things as refuse. But whoever has not tasted the things above spends his life absorbed in the things of this world. As people do today, they have not tasted the things above. That is why they have not tasted. That is precisely why we care so much about the world's approval. Today we have become afraid of men rather than God-fearing. We fear the world. Basil the Great, in his commentary on Psalm 44, says, "When spiritual beauty, namely Christ, is revealed to the human soul, everything it formerly loved appears ugly and worthy of rejection." Once a person comes to know Christ, none of this matters to them anymore. That is why Paul, when he saw the sheer beauty of Christ, notice what he says, "I count all things as rubbish, that I may gain Christ." So if you still see people taking the world into account, and you hear them saying, "Well, we have to live, we have children, what are we supposed to do? How will we marry them off? What are we going to build?" Know that they still have no relationship with Christ at all. And this beast, the world, comes between them and Christ. I am not telling you to reject the world altogether. Simply seize it by the collar and keep it at a distance so that it does not bite you. That is what you must watch out for. Say good morning, but keep your distance, because for the present you are likely to bite. Do you understand? Good morning, but then remain in your own home. Good morning, but then return to your work. No constant coming and going, no accepting their opinions, no imitating them. Only then will you be consistent. These unfortunate people also bear the image of God, but you must protect yourself as you would from a disease, because many diseases are circulating today, especially spiritual ones. If a person had reflected on what I said earlier, that in this world he is a tenant, not a permanent resident, he would arrange his affairs rather differently. And if he also kept in mind what has its proper place during the days of the Triodion, when we hear those beautiful words, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world," he would conduct his life differently and use this present time to prepare himself for the kingdom that has been prepared. If you are unprepared, improvident, and have set nothing in order, where will you go? There must therefore be faith. All these things are closely connected, and you know that people discuss many matters, even Christians do. They devour the flesh of their brothers. They accuse others and pass judgment on them. I do not know when they are judging, when they are condemning, and when they are offering advice. I do not know when one becomes the other, because there is no clear dividing line in this matter. And yet few people speak about paradise and prepare themselves for it. Very few. I once read about a rich man who had many servants. Among them was an elderly servant who was a Christian. His master loved him dearly. One day the master died, and this elderly servant was inconsolable. Everyone else had something to say and found some measure of consolation. But this servant, this elderly man, was inconsolable. He would not be comforted, so someone approached him and said, "But why, Uncle Christos, are you weeping like this? You are a Christian, are you not? Was your master not a good man? Has he not gone to paradise? Are you grieving because he has gone to paradise?" The servant replied, "If he had gone to paradise, I would not be grieving, but he has not gone to paradise." "How do you know? How could such a good man not go to paradise?" he replied. "Let me tell you what my reasoning and my tears are based on. Whenever my master was going abroad, he made preparations. He bought a ticket, packed his suitcases, and telephoned to reserve a seat and a hotel room there, and so forth. Whenever he was going to the spa, he did the same. He prepared and talked about it. Arrange this, prepare that for me, buy my ticket, put everything in order, telephone to reserve a room, and so on. But I never heard him make any preparation for paradise. He never spoke about it, nor did he send word ahead to the place where he was going. And indeed the man was right. He was telling the truth. The day before yesterday I had announced an outing for tomorrow afternoon to St. Hierotheos, that we'd go over there one afternoon. For the first time, a woman came up to me and began to cry. She was dressed in black. "If you have a seat, Mr. Panagopoulos." "We'll see if I have one," I said. "Give me your number, because I don't have a seat right now. I'll call you." I could see that this woman had been bereaved of someone, though I did not know whom. Yesterday, a seat became available, so I telephoned her. "Mrs. So-and-so, a seat has become available. Will you be able to come?" She began weeping again over the telephone. So I say to her, "Yesterday I saw you crying, and today I hear you crying over the phone. Is there anything I can say that might help?" She says, "There's nothing you can say, Mr. Panagopoulos, because this is about my husband. I lost my man a year and a half ago." "No, you have not lost him. I want to believe that he has gone on ahead. Not even objects are truly lost. If you are Christians, that is not a good way to put it," she said. "Of course I am. I am a very devout Christian." "Very well." As we spoke, I tried to draw from her whether, and to what extent, her husband had departed from this world in a spiritually prepared state, so that I might have some foundation on which to offer her a few words. Believe me, for 20 minutes I could not get an answer. He was good. He was wonderful. She used 1,000 descriptions and 1,000 praises. But when it came to whether he had gone to Holy Confession and received Holy Communion, she passed over the matter and said nothing. She simply continued speaking and weeping over how good this man had been. "I cannot get to the heart of the matter," I said. "Please help me, or else I will stop troubling you. Tell me, did this man have a relationship with the Church of Christ, this good man, so that I may know what to say to you and how to answer you?" "Of course," she said. "He went to church on all the great feasts." In the end, she did not answer me, because the man had done nothing. Yet to her he remains an idol. He remains the man whom she has lost. Not the man who was lost, no, not the one who was lost, but the man she lost, as we commonly say, "I lost my dear one." He was not a hairpin that she had misplaced, but she would never accept, nor could she believe, that he himself was lost. And Christ would be unjust, she thinks, if he had cast such a good man into hell. There are many people like this. And I want you to take this seriously. Many people who are good by worldly standards, even very good, will find themselves in hell, and indeed in a particular hell of their own. For the kingdom of heaven is not meant simply for good people. "Is it meant for bad people then?" someone may ask. No, it is meant for Christians, for Christians, for there are many seemingly good, wonderful people who are neither truly good nor Christian at all. This is the point I want to make. Concerning what I was telling you earlier about the eyes, the divine John Chrysostom puts it this way. He is speaking about people who often embody the world for us, people close to us, people whom we believe we need, and yet we must put them aside and shut the door on them as we would on the world. He says, "If your eye causes you to stumble, cut it out. If your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off." That is in Matthew 5:29, and again in chapter 18, verses 8 and 9 of the same evangelist. And Chrysostom says, "If we have to cut ourselves off from a limb of our own body to cut a piece of ourselves away," he says, "when that limb is in a bad state, when it is doing us harm, how much more from friends who are badly disposed toward us? And so concord is not a good thing in every case. Let's not fall out with them, just as separation is not an evil in every case either. For sometimes there is a good division and an evil harmony. Harmony is not always good," he says. "You tell yourself, 'I do not want to fall out with them.' But you must fall out with them if they are ruining you. You must break with them. You must shut the door." So then, separation is not an evil in every case either. Why? Because, well, how? You two aren't on speaking terms anymore because you're doing me harm. It harms my soul, it harms my children, it harms my wife, my husband, and that is exactly why something like this is blessed by God, yes. We keep up these relationships, supposedly so as not to fall out with Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so. You know how it is, we need them, and so on, as though we needed them more than God. But when, for the sake of your soul, you cut yourself off from what has become like your right eye, namely the world, will God not bless you by replacing it with something wholesome, or by coming to your aid? Besides, how many people know the right people and have the world on their side, and yet they accomplish nothing? And then you see other people who have God, and they accomplish everything. Because God, if I may put it this way, can press even the devil into service to make him work for our good. Even the devil. God not only has angels and archangels and people who belong to him, he can even press the devil into service for our sake. So let us not be deceived. The world contains many evils, and here we see this man who wants to reach Christ. The world makes it difficult for him to reach Christ, and I want to dwell on this point. There are Christian homes, I know three such Christian homes, that open their doors for dances, hold banquets, and organize all kinds of evening parties and gatherings. Why? Because they have daughters, and if they do not open their homes in this way, how will they find husbands for them? And yet, if someone were to read John Chrysostom's homily about Herod's birthday banquet, where the precious head of the forerunner was handed over, his hair would stand on end. He would be horrified. As far as you can, stay away from such homes. As far as you can, have nothing to do with them. And as far as you can, keep your own family away from them. They may call these celebrations innocent. They may call the company innocent. They may say they are only relatives and cousins. That is where corruption begins. It begins with relatives, cousins, godparents, acquaintances, close male and female friends. That is where corruption begins. For anyone who does not have Christ, and the proof that he does not have Christ is that he does such things, feels an emptiness, and that is why he does them. He has no trust in God. Be assured that the devil is present there, camouflaged beneath the fashions of the day. During the summer, when I was at the baths in Edipsos, I had to speak there every evening to various groups of people. As I was looking for material, I found a fine passage by St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain on these very matters, the merrymaking, dances, revelries, and diversions of the world. Let us go out and unwind, brother. Let us go somewhere to relax. We have been invited. There is no harm in it. There are many excuses. Listen, then, to how these things are described, so that you may understand what the world offers, an obstacle to the salvation of the human person. The house where dances are held is a school of the devil. The devil is the teacher, and the other demons are his assistants. The leading pupils, interpreters, and prompters are the singers, the dancers, and those who play the instruments. Learn, you wretched Christians, lessons in fornication, adultery, licentiousness, drunkenness, carousing, loose laughter, sodomy, men lying with men, filthy talk, foolish talk, debauchery, and every lesson of unrestrained indulgence. That wretched house is the arena of a satanic contest. Satan himself is the one who stages the contest and awards the crown. The spectators of the contest are the rest of the demons who look on and rejoice, and the wrestlers and the competitors are the dancers, the singers, and the players of the instruments. And the one who gets crowned, the one who deserves the prize, is whoever danced or sang the most shamelessly, whoever pleased them all and beat out everyone else. But the crown he wins is sin, and the reward, the prize, is eternal punishment. How is it that you, a baptized Christian, find yourself there? That's what he says. How completely different must the way of salvation be, a way the world neither teaches nor holds before us. St. Basil the Great says, "Let fasting cure drunkenness." Fasting instead of drunkenness. Let a psalm set right the shameful song. Let tears become the remedy for laughter, instead of dancing. Let the knee be bowed. Instead of clapping the hands, let the breast be struck. Instead of adorning your clothing, put on humility, and above all, let almsgiving redeem you from your sins. This shows what the world is to the soul seeking Christ, and what the human person must do. These are the antidotes, as St. Basil the Great calls them. And yet there are people who say, now that man knows how to live, he is enjoying his life. When someone lives a prodigal life, how can you say that he is really living, or that such a life can be good for him? These are the dictates of the world, not of Christ. Aristotle says this, concerning the prodigal man, of whom some will say, you do not know what a good heart he has, he writes, the prodigal man is not wicked in character, but foolish. The prodigal man is not wicked in character, he has a good heart, but he is foolish. He is foolish, Aristotle says it. It is not some churchman with incense saying it, so that people can dismiss it. Aristotle himself says it. Fear the world then, and be on your guard against it, because the world is a great obstacle. But when a person truly desires Christ, as this man did, even while others treated him with contempt, he cries out all the more. Christ knows who he is, what he needs, and what obstacles will arise. Do you think he does not know Christ allows him to reveal all his fervor and all his faith? No one can stop a person who truly wants something, as I told you earlier. Someone in love knows no obstacles and no limits. He cries out all the more, and Christ stops and says, "Tell him to come." And the moment Christ stopped, wasn't everything resolved? The obstacles disappeared. Christ is like a light that you switch on, and the cockroaches run into hiding. That is how Christ is. For a moment, he may appear not to hear, but Christ hears you, Christ sees you, and he wants the full brightness of your faith to shine forth. And so that his faith might be revealed and remain as an example for others. Yes, this is precisely why we must not say, I cannot fast, I cannot exercise self-restraint, I cannot do it, I keep encountering obstacles. You will encounter obstacles, struggle. And Christ will say, peace, be still, then you will do what is for your own good. And the evangelist Mark tells us a striking detail, pay attention to it, for it too is connected with the world. The evangelist Mark says of Bartimaeus, this is the name he gives him, that as soon as they told him he is calling you, he threw aside his outer garment. The blind man cast off his cloak so that he could reach him more quickly. Who travels more easily and comfortably, the one weighed down with baskets or the one who goes with empty hands? It is the one who carries less in his hands. So take heed, this world creates difficulties for us along with anxiety, anguish, and tribulations. These things draw us away from Christ and make it difficult for us to reach him. Yes, faith was required of this man and so forth. These are things you already know. I wanted to dwell only on that great beast called the world, which, unfortunately, we all fear. And let us, at least we Christians, strive to change inwardly, so that Christ may not be blasphemed because of us, and so that our lives may be an open letter that anyone can read. Let everyone who approaches us sense that we bear something upon us. It is not that we possess anything of our own. We merely bear him, while we ourselves are of no importance. We are always like the colt, the little donkey that Christ mounted when he entered Jerusalem. As I was saying on Thursday when they invited me to speak there, they spread their garments before him and laid palm branches in his path, and so forth. But they did not do this for the donkey. The proof is that, as soon as the Lord dismounted, they took the donkey back to the stable. They threw them down for the one who was riding, and that donkey is us, or it's what we ought to be. Christians are to think of themselves as colts of donkeys, humble little beasts of burden, but the one we carry him we must never insult, because we walk into people's homes and we can't tell whether they're worldly homes or Christian ones. There is no difference at all. We enter offices and workplaces occupied by Christians, yet we cannot tell whether they are worldly people. They have simply added religion, the church, and a candle to their lives without renouncing their former way of life. We must therefore be different and not become a cause for our Lord to be blasphemed. Otherwise, tomorrow he will say to us, "Depart, you workers of lawlessness, because you did not confess me either in word or in deed." May this never befall us or anyone in the world. Amen.